Hey everybody, this is Shannon with VIP Kid World, and welcome back. For this podcast, we are going to be finishing our book reading of Little Soldiers by Lenora Chu by completing the 13th chapter titled The Middle Ground. I hope that those of you who are listening have enjoyed the journey from here. It has been amazing for me to get the chance to read this again. I've taken so much from the book, and I've really appreciated all of the support and all of those of you who have reached out to me to tell me how you have enjoyed the book reading. And I really do hope that now that we are about to finish this book, that you feel a little bit closer in understanding your VIP Kids students, their lives, their world, the education system in China, and hopefully that helps us to become better teachers for these amazing students that we see on a daily basis. So, as always, forgive me for my mispronunciation of words in Chinese since I don't know them. I'm sure you'll be glad to stop hearing that. But without any further ado, let's finish the book, Little Soldiers. Maybe the hybrid of American and Chinese systems is perfect. Liu Jian, a mathematician working for the Ministry of Education. We always made sure to attend the birthday parties of Rainey's classmates. My fellow Chinese parents expended mountains of effort planning these festive gatherings, and I love that they opened a window onto changing Chinese parenting and cultural mores. Each party was a mini sociological study, served up with green tea and cake. More and more, I saw that urban Chinese were embracing American and European customs. Champagne and seafood brunches, caricaturists and clowns, European citadel-inspired bouncy castles. Of course, Chinese touches were always present. A greeting line commanded by parent hosts, a professional photographer, a karaoke solo by the birthday girl. To me, these celebrations indicated a quickly shrinking, converging world. A decade ago, a Shanghainese girl might never have met an American on her home turf. Today, I am raising my children in China, and my son stands in her receiving line. At the same time, the Chinese are heading abroad to America, Europe, Australia, and other countries in greater numbers, fostering a global exchange of ideas more quickly than at any time in the past. Sometimes, the best intentions are lost in translation. One Sun Qingling mom prided herself on being well-traveled, and for her little girl's birthday party, she purchased a piñata. The only foreign parent there, I watched, enthralled, as a staple of my American childhood became a modern Chinese fascination. Most American parents of my ilk know the piñata's party parameters. Children filed into a single line, a safe distance back, three swings per blindfolded batter, plastic bags at the ready for spilled loot. I witnessed none of that order here. A scrum of children thronged around the piñata, which took the form of Elsa, the main character of the Disney film Frozen, in an undulating mosh pit. The birthday girl whacked at Elsa's face erratically with a heavy baton, the bat whizzing far too close to noses and baby teeth. I sprang to action. "Children, form one line and back away from the piñata," I said, in Mandarin, inching into the throng with arm outstretched, seemingly the only parent who recognized the mortal danger posed by Elsa. But swings continued at random, baton passing from hand to hand in no particular order. "Let it go! Let it go!" I imagined Elsa singing, before deciding on the opposite. I raised my voice. "One line! One line! Back away from the piñata." I urged louder. This time I tried to position myself in front of the Elsa. "And we should take turns with the bat." Still, the children rushed past me like whitewater around a boulder. And as I transported to the side, I felt a tug on my elbow. Rainey had popped out from the crowd. "Mom, Mom, Mom, don't worry about it, okay?" he said in English before the scrum swallowed him again. In this moment, I realized Rainey had become Chinese in a way I never would be. For one, I lacked his easy comfort with enormous surging crowds. I carefully retreated a safe distance back, and what ensued was China. Pandemonium eventually finding its own pattern of order. Magically, no child took a blow to the face during 15 minutes of swatting, and finally, Elsa's arm fell off. The pinata tumbled to the floor. I braced myself for the familiar rush of children scrambling for candy, only to find the kids wandering off, bored. Elsa was an empty cardboard box lying battered on the floor. For all her preparations, the birthday girl's mother had missed the point of the exercise. She didn't know to ram the pinata full of sweets and treats. I wanted to chuckle, then to educate and inform the girl's mother. But here, Rainey again materialized before me, pulling my ear down to his level. By now, my son had far surpassed his mother's ability to skip seamlessly between one culture and another. And as a 5-year-old, he keenly sensed when I needed guidance, or even an intervention.
"Shh, I know, Mom, I know. But don't say anything, okay?"
he whispered, sparing me an embarrassing exchange. Rainey was skilled at saving face, and he nudged me to leave the mom in blissful ignorance. Sometimes the best intentions need some massaging, or a little cultural translation at an appropriate time. As my reporting journey continued, I witnessed this phenomenon of adoption and interpretation happening inside Chinese education too, with plenty getting lost in translation. A few years ago, one of Beijing's top public schools decided it wanted its students to have international eyes. I recognized features of the prototypical American high school in their efforts. Rankings would no longer be posted. Textbooks would be left at school. Class sizes were whittled down to 25 maximum. A mental health club was advertised as a release valve for school pressure. Students could choose electives, including swimming, rock climbing, and frisbee. And the Zoban, reform, or literally walk class, meant students changed rooms for each subject. Curious to peek behind the curtain, I rang the school to introduce myself, then flew up to Beijing. National Day School was founded in 1951, teacher Dai Cheng told me, on a blazing hot spring day, greeting me at the guard gate. The school's first graduates served as People's Liberation Army commanders. We passed a monument that conjured up a giant machine-graded multiple-choice answer sheet. 3 diamond-shaped concrete blocks, 30 feet tall, with a hole punched out of each. He seemed proudest of the walk class reform. Now, our students can meet a batch of friends in one class and meet different people when they go to the next class, said Dai, a plump man with a bowl cut who chatted animatedly. Amanda would have welcomed this change. She'd call her traditional Chinese classroom a chamber of stagnation, as she sat with the same 30, 40, or 50 odd students for an entire career of schooling. Individuality and choice were also on the menu. We have found traditional authoritarian Chinese teaching has many ill effects and deviates from the essence of education, which is to serve individuals. Our teachers are like friends, equals. I doubted authoritarianism could be legislated away, but I was heartened by the effort. For an hour, I jotted notes as we walked the grounds, Dai leading the way. This is the student union president. She was just elected, I said, stopping in front of a poster hanging in a hallway corridor, displaying a photo of a skinny girl wearing glasses. You have the student unions? I asked, surprised. I wondered whether these groups were arranged only for show.
Yes,
Dai responded firmly. When pressed, students can express opinions and make proposals, and the union communicates those to various departments. Students could also send complaints online or sit with the headmaster at lunch hour.
Has anything unexpected happened?
I asked.
Yes,
Dai admitted, squinting in the sunlight. Students care about their rights. We didn't expect this. They complained to different departments and tried to get their problem solved. Teacher Dai seemed genuinely surprised, and I found his naivete endearing.
Can you give me an example? I asked.
We approached the school museum, and Dai swung open the door so we could take shelter from the heat.
There was no hot water in the winter, and the students were not satisfied, he said.
We approached a large bust of the school's founder, displayed before a pictorial history of the school, which reached 65 years into the past and spanned 3 walls.
Before there was only cold water? I asked.
Yes, we thought cold water could enhance the endurance and willpower of the students, Dai said, with a chuckle that, for the first time, hid a bit of nervousness. But we're more humane now. And the demands kept coming, Dai said. One group wanted recycling bins. Another targeted teacher perks, including elevators that have been off limits to students, who have toted books up multiple flights of stairs for decades.
Now students and teachers ride the elevator together, Dai told me.
National Day, students have even managed to lighten up junshun, or military training, one of the most brutal physical tests that school children all over China endure. The students protested the drills as inhumane and dogmatic, Dai told me, and the school nixed the most grueling ones.
What are the limits to change?
I asked Dai.
There have been some negative consequences,
Dai said slowly.
Students have begun openly breaking rules and disobeying teachers. China lacks a civil society, and when people are granted some freedoms, there isn't a compass guiding their behavior.
Can the school handle these new freedoms? I asked. Dai Chang was silent for a few seconds before laughing, gently releasing the worry from his face.
We will see, he said. We will see.
Change is afoot at schools in major Chinese cities. For decades, the education ministry has been patient, pumping out policies for reform like a talkative police sergeant that drones on and on while the crowd never listens. Yet change is happening at ground level, driven less by the sergeant and more by public schools that enjoy the funding, special designation, or political clout to experiment. Private schools also have certain freedoms, though Beijing is currently ramping up efforts to ensure they keep a government-sanctioned political curriculum. China is in the process of reform, and we can see that there's nothing that should remain unchanged, especially institutionally, said Wang Feng, my education ministry source. From our macro policy perspective, everything needs to be modified. As the grass seedlings of experimentation sprout, Chinese families aren't standing idly by. Patience has never been much of a modern Chinese virtue. Students are heading abroad for education in a steady pipeline that fattens each year, emptying out into the United States, the UK, Australia, and even Japan and France. Teachers and education officials are also going overseas for training, education, and work. These Chinese leave their imprint on their adopted communities and also return home with new ideas about education. The pipeline runs into China, too. Nearly 4 million foreigners have come to study in China over the past two decades, hailing from more than 200 countries. This shrinking world dynamic is making for a global mix in educational ideas faster than anyone ever imagined. And this exchange is happening on every level, between individuals, communities, institutions, and governments. This won't be easy. My own little family faced a reckoning as we grappled with new ideas and an unfamiliar environment. And so will the Chinese. China's is an education system steeped in thousands of years of tradition, yet confronting a period of unprecedented change. It's a school system whose methods are constantly challenged, but whose results, at least in Shanghai, others wish to emulate. As Chinese educators work to develop areas they believe are deficient, such as creative thinking, leadership abilities, socio-emotional competencies, and other soft skills, they must confront some new realities. To succeed means a student might sometimes step out of line. In the process, test scores might fall. Lines of authority be subject to questioning, and long-held institutions challenged. Will Chinese parents, teachers, administrators, and the government be willing to accept change and what that may mean for society? One educator summed up the problem for me. The Chinese want creativity and expect their children to attend universities overseas, but they have problems with boys and girls holding hands, she said. Just as this American parent had hoped to pluck items off menu of Chinese education, yes, on math rigor, no, for unblinking obedience, so do the Chinese when they ponder Western-style culture. On the flip side, Americans and Europeans are feeling a little uncertain themselves. As politician after educator after politician lectures them about lifting student achievement. We need to take a strong look at ourselves in mathematics, particularly since we're beginning to see a downward trend across assessments, said Peggy Carr, the top official overseeing education statistics. U.S. students are running in place. We're losing ground, said John King in 2016. The U.S. Education Secretary at the time. The chorus has become as loud as blaring bullhorn at the entrance gate, only fitting as China holds a special place in the global dialogue. Shanghai students' top place finishes were so startling, in part because the test doesn't purport to measure the knowledge you've acquired, but rather what kids can do with what they've learned. Few expected China's stereotypical rote learners to top the rankings, and it was a wake-up call for education watchers around the world. The British also brought into the clamor for action. Various education officials set goals of a top five PISA finish in 2020. And one policymaker flew in Shanghai teachers to school their British counterparts on how best to teach math. Yet, in America, at least, we tussle constantly over who can set standards, what they should be, and how best to hold accountable those who deliver education. This back and forth is stalling progress. It's clear where we need to head, but the journey feels uncomfortable. As educators struggle with the perceived difficulty in raising academic levels, without sacrificing what the culture celebrates. How we differentiate from the rest of the world is this creative, out-of-the-box thinking. And if not stacking up on these tests mean
we need to teach to the test, then I worry we will lose our competitive edge," said Jennifer Price, at the time the principal of the high school high-performing Newton North High School. "The bureaucrats' idea is they want to see scores, production of a child, the old assembly line. But how do you measure production of a child?" Minnesota social studies teacher Brian Studer told me. "Others worry that the individuality of the student will disappear as progress ceases to have a human face, instead becoming a number measured by school and by state. The schoolhouse grass, it appears, is always greener elsewhere." I understand the concern, and I've experienced the same anxiety as a parent. As a journalist, I've searched high and low for evidence that creativity and critical thinking are quashed when we focus on our kids' academic skills. And I haven't found a direct link, though clearly they need time to experiment and explore. Yet I have stumbled upon plenty of research that suggests a strong academic foundation, couched in knowledge, enables higher order thinking and even the creative process. You can't think about something you don't know. Try it for a moment. And the more you know about a subject, the more sophisticated your thoughts become, said UK educator David Didow. As we all wrestle with change, the world's education systems are gravitating toward convergence in what a 21st century student should look like. It's a catchphrase that educators bandy about. We may not know exactly how to brew the magic potion, but we know what should result from drinking it. Technical abilities are important, but so are soft skills, such as leadership, creative thinking, and the ability to work with people you disagree with. Certain competencies must be integrated into everything that's done, but saying that is simplistic, American education professor William Schmidt told me. How to do it is really, really complicated, and there's no data or real pattern of success. Maybe the hybrid of American and Chinese systems is perfect, concluded Lu Jian, the mathematician who studies curriculum for the Chinese Education Ministry. Xiaodong Ling, the Chinese professor at Columbia University, said that the Chinese have gone too deep on content and the Americans have not done enough. The systems have a lot to learn from each other. The pendulum has always swung from east to west and back again, as Chinese early education professor Zhu Ninli put it. At the end of 2016, I attended an education conference in Beijing, along with academics and government leaders from countries in six continents. I watched as a French man speak of teaching engineering to the Chinese, a Turkish reform director talk about obstacles to change in a Muslim country, and an Ontario education minister talk of infusing sustainability into her school's curriculum. It was a whirling hot pot of dialogue, and after a heated debate about innovation in education, a zeitgeist phrase no one seemed to be able to clearly define, an education expert from Mexico finally threw up his hands on stage. "The speed of change in the way we educate is staggering," the man said before a ballroom full of attendees. "We will reach 2030, and none of the things we are talking about will be relevant at all." At least we're having the conversation. As Rainey approaches his final year in Chinese kindergarten, soon to enter primary school, I am clear on my priorities. I want academic rigor, but I don't want him huddled over books every waking hour like his Chinese peers. I want him to learn to draw, play sports, and enjoy leisure, as well as cultivate a penchant for drama and literature.
and comedy. If he wants to hop, skip, or scramble on the way to retrieving a ball, diving over the couch, or scrabbling under the kitchen table, he's welcome to do it. I want that exact middle, that convergence, or what we believe the ideal 21st century education should look like. Policymakers are inching the world's school systems toward an increasingly globalized future, but none have yet arrived in a satisfying way. As we wait, I'm cobbling together my own solution. Few education experts the world over would dispute that in the elementary years, the content of Chinese education is robust and rigorous. The math curriculum is advanced and well-developed. Teachers specialize in subject areas from day one of first grade. And a school child who stays in until fourth or fifth grade should acquire Chinese literacy. And it's nearly 3,500 characters. I like the Chinese system's parameters for academic rigor. If you have to focus scarce energy and resources, focus on the early years, as a Greek education expert told me. We'll keep Rainy in the Chinese primary school as long as we can, all the while understanding there's a hard stop for his time in the Chinese system. I speak often with American, European, and Chinese friends in China, lucky enough to have choices, whether by foreign passports, connections, or resources. And we generally agree the ideal upper limit in the Chinese system is sixth grade, possibly earlier, depending on the child. We'll pull Rainy out, especially as the unseemlier aspects, back-breaking levels of homework, a slow brainwash of political education, crushing pressure from entrance exams filters in. When the negatives outweigh the positives, we will alter course. Meanwhile, we'll reap the benefits of a rigorous early education while compensating for its imperfections as much as we can. My own childhood enmeshed the Chinese way at home with the American approach in U.S. public schools. Rainey's upbringing does, too, pegged with the reverse influences from home and school. Somewhere within these constructs, we hoped to find balance. In the beginning, I looked at the Chinese education system and saw only the bad. Authoritarian teachers, rabid competition, high-stakes testing, and the anti-creativity argument, and was tempted to dismiss the entire system. True. The Chinese have a fundamentally different way of looking at the world. When international education rankings are launched into the world, a group of critics always emerges with the accusation that such tests don't account for differences in culture or government, issues like inequality or poverty, or the presence of special needs children in any particular classroom. This is only natural. Over the years, I've met a handful of global educators who explained away their students' poorer performance in some way. A Danish education expert told me that Denmark considered the Chinese math curriculum and decided to go another way. Our education goals are different than theirs. We're looking to educate rebels, he told me, chuckling maniacally while socializing with stuff suits at an education conference, looking every bit the rebel himself. A Russian education official told me PISA simply fails to measure what his country values in 15-year-old students. We believe fundamental knowledge is more important than critical reasoning at this time, since 80% of our students eventually go on to college, he said, dismissing the test with a wave of his hand. The Americans also have their self-soothing explanations, and the no Chinese creativity argument seems to ring loudest. Certainly, an American teacher wouldn't dream of shaming a student in front of his peers or locking a child in an empty classroom. Indeed, she might be dragged into court. Meanwhile, the Chinese are bewildered by the American obsession with sports, such as football, which keep preteen boys circuit training on rubber tires during the hours their Chinese counterparts are drilling in algebra. Cultural differences are stark, as are disparities in what different countries value. Not to mention that China's is a developing economy, while Americans and Europeans have generally enjoyed prosperity and power in the last century. But that doesn't mean we have nothing to learn from each other. To their credit, despite their dismissal of the Chinese way, the chuckling Dane and the dismissive Russian had considered the Chinese curriculum and traveled to Asia regularly for education conferences. And as we argue over whether such international rankings matter, China and other countries are working to equip their kids with the higher order skills that are important for a rapidly changing world. And are also quietly demonstrating stellar math, reading, and science abilities, at least in major urban centers. American, Chinese, Indian, Australian, and French kids are now competing against one another for college admission spots, and they'll later face off for jobs in the global marketplace for talent. Meanwhile, jobs for less skilled graduates are moving to developing countries, and the opportunities that are staying in the West are being slowly replaced by automation, the experts say. The Chinese will be catching up on all those soft skills that Westerners pride themselves on. It might take 2, 3, or 4 generations, but it's coming. Meanwhile, far more Chinese are learning English today. It's part of China's national curriculum than the number of Westerners learning Mandarin, the most spoken language in the world. I'm certainly not advocating increasing the competitive stakes in education by testing our kids the Chinese way. I'm just saying we should consider doing things a different way. Try something that scares you. You might just be surprised. For me, that something started with shaking up my assumptions about what's possible with my child and with his schooling. Chinese lesson number one was that kids are much more resilient than I ever imagined. The day-to-day challenges of Chinese school weren't what we'd expected, but surprisingly, through all of this, we have endured. You may even say we're thriving. I'd batted down desperate fears that his schooling environment would snap him in two, and I'm certain much more of this kind of anxiety is in my future. But quite the opposite has resulted. Rainey embraces hard work, adjusts well to adverse situations, and has become an open and curious child. He has leadership skills, and he makes me and his friends laugh. This is a gift he'll carry into the future. As we approach the end of the second school year, Rob and I continue to celebrate certain behaviors and compensate for others. In this way, we always had our finger on the scale. Ultimately, I believe that family culture overrides school culture, says Corinne Hua, a Brit in Shanghai whose children studied in a local system through a primary school. The former Beijing headmaster, Kang Jian, told me, "I'd estimate family's influence over character, morality, and affection of a kid at 60 to 70%. Family holds great leverage." Recently, I'd been using my leverage to ensure Rainey didn't become a boy who asked permission to do everything. "Mom, can I decorate this?" Rainey asked on a lazy Saturday morning. We just built a clay model of a boat and set it afloat in the bathtub. Rainey clearly needed some retraining. "It's your boat.
You don't need to ask.
I insisted, while my son shrugged. Another time, his teachers insisted on holding hostage his favorite toy, which they'd requested each child bring to school. Rainey asked permission to bring home his Velociraptor, only to be denied.
Did you insist?
I asked Rainey.
No, I didn't.
He said, glancing up forlornly.
Teacher's song said no, so I just left it at school.
I was infuriated at what seemed like purposeless authoritarianism. I marched into that classroom the next day at pickup, beeline for the toy box, teased out Rainey's Velociraptor, and marched out of the classroom door with my son's plastic animal under my t-shirt. A pointless maneuver, since it's almost impossible to conceal a hard, pointy-clawed plastic animal, but the attempt to hide it made me feel less confrontational. On the way home, Rainey became anxious.
Mom, did you ask the teacher for permission?
He said, right hand gripping the dinosaur. No. You know that I didn't. I challenged him.
Did you see the teacher? Did she tee you?
I don't think so. Do you think we would get in trouble? I asked.
No, but you're supposed to ask,
he told me. Not always, I responded, voice rising a register. Not always. You're not always supposed to ask.
Yes, you are, Mom.
No, you're not. The teachers don't always know best, Rainey, okay? I said. But, keep that to yourself, all right? Rainey looked up at me and smirk on his face. Somewhere in there, Rainey was developing leadership skills. After enduring a gruesome round of entrance tests and interviews, including one that required me and Rob to stand before 40 parent competitors and a principal with a bell, to deliver two-minute speeches about parenting, while our kids took math tests in another room. We chose a Chinese elementary school a block down the street. This school was known for its arts, and the academic pressure wasn't known to be so intense. I'd watch as Rainey grew into his skin, in first and second grades, with a natural confidence and a social intelligence that no textbook could teach. He was also a nice kid, and eventually he'd be elected a class monitor by his peers. In Chinese class, he began writing characters on command, and also quickly learned double and triple digit addition and subtraction. Soon, the class moved on to multiplication. Outside of school, we attended swimming, tennis, and soccer classes taught by American and Australian and Nigerian coaches. We also began frequenting museums in Shanghai and reading English literature at home. We also invited Chinese friends to birthday parties where the piñata was filled with candy. When he was 6 years old, Rainey would insist on being dropped off at a birthday party where he'd be the only child who couldn't speak French. We'd befriended the birthday boy, along with his Belgian father, through a local Chinese soccer league.
I had a great time, Rainey told me afterward.
Did you understand anything the kids were saying?
No, but I still played Star Wars with them,
he responded, grinning at the thought of lightsabers and Jedis. This incident made me proud. My son had parachuted willingly, alone, into an environment without the skills to communicate, and he'd had a fabulous time. More and more, I was having affirming moments like these. As Rainey's second year in Chinese school grew to a close, I checked in with my Chinese friends before our annual summertime visit to the United States. Darcy invited me to witness his day of reckoning as he sat for the Gaokao, the National College Entrance Exam, along with 9 million students throughout China. I rose early on a Saturday in June
to plant myself outside his assigned testing site for the millennia-old tradition of songkao, literally send test, in which parents and grandparents usher their progeny off to the races. As I approached the Shanghai Middle School where he would be taking the exam, I spotted evidence of a society on hold. Police cars blocking off sections of street, orange and white barriers arranged around the entrance, and throngs of parents and kids crowding ever closer, clutching spare pencils, tissue packs, and water bottles. Local shopkeepers emerging to bear witness to the spectacle. City buses came to a rest along this particular street, paying homage to this momentous occasion. I stepped into the crowd as it pushed forward, a mass of bobbing black-haired heads belonging to everyone who might have a stake in this game, parents, grandparents, teachers, and students. And ever so often, a student would extricate himself, shoulders lurching forward, to step over the orange barricade and walk toward the school entrance. I scanned the crowd for Darcy. The last time I'd seen him, about 3 weeks prior, he'd shown me a black fountain pen, handling it gently, as one might a blind baby mouse. He eased off the cap to reveal a shiny gold point. "This is my special pen," he told me. I detected a blush, and I knew I'd stumbled upon a secret. "What makes it special?" I said, fixating on him intently. "Okay," he said, taking a breath. "A girl gave it to me." "A girl? Girlfriend? You have a girlfriend?" Darcy's parents prohibited dating, which, as many rules in China do, only serve to force illicit behavior underground. The pair would arrange meeting by text on their banned phones and slip into each other's dormitories after study hall. Brandishing the shiny pen, Darcy told me, "I'll use this to write my name, but I'll use a regular pen for the rest of the test." He held the instrument for a moment, a flicker of calm momentarily crossing his face. At the test site, a procession of boys and girls grasped clear zipper pouches, toting pencils and erasers, their ammunition for the upcoming marathon, which would take place over 2 days. As I watched them filter into the school, it occurred to me that some students enjoyed advantages a casual onlooker would never know. Darcy had passed his interview at Jiao Tong University, so he'd need only score above the first tier cutoff to snag a slot. That partly explained his calm. Bearing a catastrophic memory failure, Darcy was likely to succeed. His girlfriend, a history major whom teachers had passed over for this privilege, would have to test in straight up, Darcy told me. Parents surged forward. A guard pushed back. "Jiayou! Add oil!" The crowd began cheering as the children walked, growing smaller and finally disappearing into the school. "Don't be too anxious! Go slow! Check your answers!" advised a group of teachers who'd arrived to cheer on their students. A guard approached me as I continued to scan the crowd for Darcy. "The Wheel of Fortune," he said, addressing my face of worry. "Come again?" I asked. "The Wheel of Fortune. It's out of your hands now. Don't worry. Your child will test well," he reassured me. Did I look old enough to have a teenager? At 8:38 a.m., Darcy popped out from the crowd. He wore an easy smile, and his dimples were out. I watched as he made his way toward the entrance. He had been clearing his required score by a large margin in practice tests. The boy walking beside him showed no such calm. He stepped through the gates and suddenly pivoted in panic. "I don't have water!" he shouted in the general direction of his parents.
A ripple of empathy passed through the crowd. It could have been anyone's child. And someone coughed up a spare bottle of so he could proceed. Gradually, the procession of students slowed, and a guard glanced at his watch. 9 o'clock, he announced. They've started. The crowd milled about uncertainly for a few moments, then began to dissipate, disappearing into the shops lining the street or heading toward police barricades to rejoin the main road. Parents, grandparents, and teachers, too, had reached the end of a long journey. All they could do now was wait. 19 days later, at precisely 8 o'clock in the evening, Darcy logged onto the computer as his parents sat in the other room, casually eavesdropping. The cursor on the screen blinked a few times, then his score appeared. 474 out of 600 possible points. For students wanting to study physics, chemistry, and biology, the cutoff line for the first-tier universities that year turned out to be 423. He'd cleared the hurdle by 51 points. 10 minutes later, a text message arrived from his girlfriend, bearing a single number, 449. A little close for comfort, Darcy affirmed, but it should be okay. A week later, I checked in with Darcy to find his life anything but dandiao, monotonous. Gaokao was over. Dad had bought him an iPhone. He was learning to drive. A leisure trip with his best friend was on the horizon. Darcy had gotten a job bussing tables at a bar and lounge popular with expats to learn about foreigners. Here, an entirely new world was revealed to him. After his first shift, he regaled me with the story of Americans who drop $15 on a single cocktail. Germans who painted their face red, yellow, and black. It was World Cup season. And seated so freely arranged that the oldest and most important person wasn't required to sit at the head. It was so lively, he said with a smile. In America, outgoing people must be more attractive. With this knowledge, he'd embarked on a plan to change his personality. I want to be more gregarious, he told me. His father soon stepped in to foil his plans, demanding he quit bussing tables on day two. Darcy's face was full of disappointment. My father told me I needed to save my strength for college, he told me. His official acceptance letter had come from Jiao Tong University. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. It began. Darcy had just completed a major educational milestone, but already he was looking ahead to the next mountain. Amanda got into one of America's most prestigious universities, celebrated for its Nobel laureates and Fields Medal mathematical wizards. I expected momentous celebration, but instead, I found a depressed and uncertain teenager. Amanda's mother was in the middle of treatments for stage 3 cancer. She'd been diagnosed when Amanda was studying abroad during her junior year. The family buried the news until her return to China almost a year later. Truth always took a back seat to education. Yet it wasn't her mother's illness that got Amanda down. It was the state of her relationship with her parents. Amanda broke down on her next visit. I feel like all I've done in the past 10 years to please my parents or pay them back, she said, wiping away tears. I used to be part of my mother, but now I should be an individual. Her tears were those of sudden realization. She understood her mother and father were never going to let her go. The umbilical cord she thought would be severed when she set off for college would now stretch from Shanghai all the way to the United States. Amanda's parents wanted daily text updates and phone calls, with a heavy hand in choosing her major and her career path forward. I thought about the fights I'd had with my father just before I was to leave for college. Was my life his to direct or mine to own? "But you'll be out of their reach next year," I told Amanda, trying to sound cheery. "Will you really text them every day? You don't have to. You don't have to at all." After heading to Stanford at 18, I fielded a phone call from my father nearly every day, huddled over a phone that I pulled into the hallway at all odd hours. I let my father choose my field of study, my summer internships, and even my first job, until I finally put up my hand. We didn't speak for a year. Then abruptly, as if he'd suddenly realized that having me in his life meant losing his grip, he let me go. "Guide the way, but don't suffocate," he later confessed to me after I became a parent. "What choice do I have?" Amanda responded, her voice low and quiet. "Their happiness depends on my happiness." That year, Amanda had begun reading Escape from Freedom. In the writings of the German philosopher Erich Fromm, Amanda found parallels in his ideas about a person released from a power or convention. Most individuals harbor the illusion they have freedom, but actually they submit to an authority they're not aware of, Amanda told me. They live to expectations anyway, instead of living for themselves. I got the analogy. Whether she found physical freedom from her parents, system, or culture, America was certainly an ocean away from Shanghai. She was afraid she'd never find mental freedom. "You will, Amanda," I told her. "You will find your own way. It takes time." As the weeks counted down to her departure for college, one baby step towards liberty was prompted by mother's own panic. They told me they regret what they did to me, raising me with so much pressure, Amanda told me, shaking her head. "She is a teacher. My parents are more educated than most people in Shanghai. But they still did it to me anyway. Now my mom is saying it's more important to be happy than successful." To me, it was clear where blame should lie for each transgression in Amanda's young life. The insane pressure to perform on Chinese system, the indestructible parent-child tether on Chinese culture. But her mother's apology could only have been prompted by her illness. For my masseuse friend Lauren, both happiness and success seemed elusive. Lauren's son, little Junjun, would ultimately fail the high school entrance exam. I traveled out to Anhui province the weekend he sat for Zhongkao, and as Lauren and I waited outside the gates, vultures were already circling. Hired men passing out flyers to vocational schools. This was Plan B for students who failed to test into academic high schools on their merits. Lauren quietly took a flyer, folded it, and slotted it into her bag, while I pretended not to notice. Later that evening, back at her apartment, Lauren revealed yet another option. She'd been given the name and number of a high school principal the next county over. The man was known to take money for points, she muttered, eyes fixated on a pot of tofu she was tending for dinner. A few weeks after I'd returned to Shanghai, I sent Lauren a message. "How did he do?" I tapped. My phone buzzed immediately with her reply. "Junjun's candidate number is 13978290432. His total score was 385. 385. Sitting in my living room in Shanghai, I gulped. "How much do you have to score to get into a normal high school?" I texted back. 500, Lauren wrote. Junjun was so far beneath the cutoff line that a pay-for-points back door into a regular high school was likely out of reach. Shortly thereafter, Lauren and her husband journeyed back to Shanghai. Their business in the countryside finished. They considered bringing Junjun with them, but they couldn't bear to think of their 18-year-old son as a migrant worker. But age 18 is about when you went out to work for the first time, I reminded her gently when she came to see me the following fall. She wore a black top and see-through mesh and sequins, the flashy garb of a migrant in the big city, eager to show she had means. Yes, but this is my son, Lauren replied, glancing past my shoulder. She'd enrolled Junjun at a vocational high school that took boarders back in Jingxian County. The school was a factory of sorts. Of all the type, all too eager to take money from parents whose children had fallen off the academic track, in hopes they still might sit for the college entrance exam. The boy was now punching time against a 3-year grind of 6 a.m. wake-up calls, 12 hours of daily study, and another 2 hours of review before lights out. A Gaokao exam prep assembly line. If his story could be told by statistics, he was unlikely to test into a top or even second-tier college from this setup. But I also knew Lauren would be thrilled simply to delay the boy's entry into migrant workforce for a few years. Tuition was 700 won a month.
Hey, that's not bad, I exclaimed.
Yes, she said, but there is a lot of competition for massages in Shanghai now. Many of my old clients have left the city.
Patience, I told her,
advocating the one quality no one in China seemed to appreciate.
Slowly, you'll make your way back.
Lauren glanced out my dining room window. It was a good pollution day, and the sun's rays filtered into the room and glittered off the black sequins on her shirt.
I have hope, she said.
My 2-year-old son, Landon, would be rejected at Sun Qingling.
Blame me,
I told Rob, after it became clear I'd single-handedly gotten us into a deep pit of a mess from which an admission slip could never be extracted. I'd taken a stand on principle, and the school's authoritarian ways again opened up a hole underneath my feet. The school offers a class for 1- and 2-year-olds called Xinjiban, or parent-child class. It's expensive, roughly $6,000 per year for a soundbite of a twice-weekly class. And it's widely viewed as a way for administrators to rake in extra cash. Many parents I knew paid the fees, but either treated the class as social hour or attended only sporadically. There wasn't much of a direction or direct benefit for the children. In my mind, the setup was ethically questionable. Unfortunately, Vice Principal Xi insisted I pay the parent-child fee to reserve a spot for Landon in the proper kindergarten, which begins taking kids the following year. I rebelled.
I don't want to enroll him until he's 3 or 4, I told Principal Xi.
We'd found each other on Big Green at pickup time. You must pay for parent-child class to reserve a spot later, she repeated. At the time, Rob and I were dealing with Rainey's nap-time police threats, and I was in no frame of mind to commit my second precious child to Sun Qingling. Fast forward a year or so. Rainey had adjusted, my heart and mind about the school coalesced, and we decided to pursue Chinese school early on in Landon's education, too. I approached Principal Xi to pick up the conversation. Her eyes glinted. Uh-oh. You didn't pay the parent-child fee, she told me, parents swarming around her on Big Green. I told you what would happen. It would be an understatement to say that I begged and cajoled,
I explained I didn't know her offer had an expiration date. I told Principal Shi that Landon had nowhere else to go. I proposed paying all back fees for the parent-child class. I enlisted a mutual friend to put in a good word. Still, the administration didn't relent. Not even when I began bringing Landon with me to pick up his brother at the end of each school day. It was my feeble attempt at emotional manipulation, but I had little else to work with.
Mommy, will this be my school too?
Landon asked in his tiny voice, dirty blonde hair ruffled and brown eyes wide, an exchange I conveyed to Principal Shi in an effort to appeal to her softer side. Principal Shi would watch Landon toddle up to his older brother's classroom for pickup and totter back across Big Green. But her eyes seemed cold, and before long she began avoiding me. One week, the office admitted the son of an American friends I'd counseled about the school. It felt like a slap in the face. Our boys were the exact same age. Landon would not attend Sun Ching Ling. Instead, he'd begin at a bilingual international kindergarten, similar to the Victoria School we'd ultimately turned down for Rainey. In the ensuing years, I'd wonder whether I should have capitulated early on to Principal Chi's, especially as Landon struggled with the discipline and Chinese language learning for which Rainey's environment had laid smooth pavement. Landon's classroom, with one English-speaking and one Chinese teacher, had few of the academic habit-forming features and the high expectations of Sun Ching Ling. On the other hand, Landon never asked permission to do anything. On the last day of middle class grades, school let out a few hours early. Rob and I chased after our son, and a few hundred schoolmates and children clambered down the stairs from the classrooms and hurtled onto Big Green. Bodies flooded the lawn, voices chirping at each other. Feng Shui Lei! School's out! Deng Wo! Wait for me! Wait! Yu Chi Wamba! Let's play together over summertime! Rainey linked hand with two classmates, Dong Yi and Guai Chi, and the trio pulled each other toward the edge of Big Green and a row of bushes.
Let's look for earthworms, Rainey yelled, digging in a patch of chocolate-colored soil and pulling on the end of a wriggling pink mass of worms.
Ech, said Dong Yi, a pretty girl in an aquamarine dress wrinkling her face. Guai Chi also recoiled. Dong Yi's mother was a soft-spoken woman, a Buddhist, who never quite fit in with the regular crowd of fancy urbanites at Sun Ching Ling. Today, she wanted to talk summer.
Do you like to sail?
She asked as our children frolicked near the bushes. We've never been sailing, I told her.
Sailing is great, she said. The children can learn balance and also be physically active at the same time.
I'd not heard of sailing previously described in this manner. A circus of excited children and parents raced toward the exit. The guards at the gate had changed out of their uniforms, and I detected some smiles among the phalanx of men that had once seemed so formidable. I glanced over at Rainey. Ever the patient leader, Rainey had managed to turn the girls' disgust into curiosity in under 10 minutes flat. And Dong Yi was now holding worms up against the daylight, checking for transparency. A pile of wiggly masses colonized a small bed of leaves at her feet.
Okay, now let's go ring the bell,
Rainey screamed out, changing course to clamber up the school's climbing trellis, 20-foot-high yellow poles connected by horizontal ropes. A red metal bell hung at the top, and he grasped the rope and pulled with all his might, body leaning into thin air above our heads.
Ding, ding, ding! Dong, dong, dong!
Rainey rang, Feng Shui, school's out!
He screamed to his classmates, who continued to stream out the exit gates.
Dongyi, her cotton dress billowing in the afternoon breeze, began scrambling up the rope, her face tilted upward. Soon the two were ringing together.
It's the last day of school, Rainy shouted to the sky. It's the last day of school,
Dongyi echoed, placing a hand just below Rainy's on the thick rope, their giggles mingling with the changing of chimes.
At ground level, Dongyi's mother droned on about her morning routine. Mother and daughter listened daily to recordings of the writings of Confucius, Mencius, Lao Tzu, and Zhuangzi.
She's been doing this since she was 3 and a half, her mother said. Research shows that the morning time after getting up is a golden time for the brain.
I thought about Rainy's morning routine. Oatmeal and milk, followed by half an hour of Star Wars Lego play.
Can Dongyi read the classics also? I asked, suspecting I already knew the answer. Yes. At night, I'll sit down and read 3 passages each day. Then I'll point to each character as she recites from memory. She just picks it up. There are many beautiful sentences in those readings. Have you heard of the Book of Changes?
Yes, but I'm not familiar with the text, I replied. I glanced up at Rainy and Dongyi, who enacted lightsaber battles over breakfast, another who awoke each morning to Confucian chants. Tired of ringing bells together, they began taking turns, yanking the rope. At this particular moment, it seemed nothing separated the two. Not nationality, language, religion, or gender. Not even proficiency with the recorder.
Dongyi's mother wrapped up her pitch. This week, we'll work on the classics of filial piety, she said. It doesn't matter how much you understand. She'll remember it. After being exposed to it for a long time, you will love it. It's classically Chinese. You should try it with Rainy sometime, she said.
I glanced skyward. It was a good pollution day, and 3 bloated clouds swam lazily along long stretches of gray sky. The principals I'd tussled with for the last 2 years were nowhere in sight. The clanging from our happy children bounced off the skyscrapers towering over the school, echoing for a few moments before dissipating into the ether.
Maybe, I said. Maybe I will.
And that is the end of our book reading. I hope that you have enjoyed the reading of Little Soldiers by Lenora Chu. I know it has definitely been a wonderful read for me again. One of the things, now that you have completed and listening to the book, I know there's quite a few of you listening. So now that the book reading is finished, I want to open this up to see what you guys have thought. This is the first time I'm asking for something like this, but maybe I'll get some responses. So I would love to know your ideas, opinions about the book. Things like, how did you like it? What was the most interesting part? Is there anything that stood out to you that you learned? How specifically do you think that this book has helped you to become a better VIP Kid teacher? I would love to know the answer to all those questions. So if you want to, please reach out to me via email at shannon.mabry.vipkid. So it's shannon.mabry.vipkid@gmail.com. And I'm going to let this go for about a month. And a month from now, I want to create another podcast as a review of what I have gotten, hopefully, some responses from you guys. And I would love to be able to read some of your answers in the next podcast and share them with everyone who's been listening. So feel free to reach out, send the email, and I'd love to read some of what you guys say on the next podcast. Feel free to include your name, where maybe what state you're from, how long you've been with VIP Kid, anything you want included in the next follow-up podcast, and probably the end of next month. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for the support, and continue to listen and tell other teachers. Hopefully, if you find it beneficial yourself, encourage others to take a look at the podcast, and there will be more podcasts to come in the future. Once again, thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.